Oh, wow. It's time for Dear Science, thanks to MOTAT, Auckland's Museum of Transport and Technology.
Kia ora, Marcus. Are you there? So if we were to start off then, we've got our first topic here is about flu vaccines and how they don't actually protect people for that long. So I was wondering, first of all, I mean, why? What is it about flu vaccines? Why do they wear off?
Over the last 10 years or so, you know, they've had some years where the vaccine has only been about 20% effective and some years where it's been about up to about 60% effective. So it varies quite a lot. But the other thing is the actual protection goes away quite quickly. So if you live in a sort of a fairly temperate region of the world and receive a shot in the early autumn, then the immunity can disappear before the end of the winter. So it's only around for a few months. And this is because, so there was a study that looked at a type of B cell. And B cells are important for your immune response. They make antibodies that can attach to and disable viruses. And these things are made, these B cells are made in bone marrow. And the study focused on a type of B cell called these bone marrow plasma cells, which continuously produce antibodies after an infection or after a vaccination. And a small portion of these B cells, so these BMPCs, these bone marrow plasma cells, they don't really last very long. So they're around for a while and then they start waning. But there's a small portion of these called memory B cells that produce antibodies. They're created in the same way, but they don't steadily pump out protective proteins. Instead, what they do is they recognize a specific virus and kick into gear only when they're re-exposed to it. And there's a small portion of these B cells, these BMPCs, actually last for an awful lot longer. And it may be possible if we can stimulate, this is the study is saying, it may be possible if we can stimulate more of these B cells that are long lasting to be created, then we may be able to develop vaccines that last longer than what we have now.
How would we go about doing that? Does the study tell you anything about that?
Good question. Well, so this is more speculative, but originally when influenza vaccines were first developed, which was in the 1940s, they used compounds called adjuvants, and these were additives that act as irritants. And they ramp up the immune response, but it may also help to increase the amount of viral proteins in the vaccine. It ramps up the immune response, and the way they did that was by increasing the amount of viral proteins in the vaccines. They also used an oil water mixture that irritated the body, irritated and produced a bigger immune system response. At the time, this caused ulcers at the injection site and soreness, and it was dropped from later vaccines. And over the years, the industry have sort of removed more and more of these adjuvants out of the vaccines so that we really get very, it's very rare to get a response, an adverse response to a flu vaccine nowadays. But as a consequence, we get fewer side effects, but this has reduced maybe the effectiveness of the vaccines, or at least the long-term effectiveness of the vaccines. And so for the past decade or two, some improved adjuvants, these molecules that irritate the immune system, these have started to become added back in. And in Europe, in some parts of Europe, in Italy, for instance, they have an oil-water mixed adjuvant that they've added into the immune system in a safer way than it was done originally, and it's able to trigger a bigger immune response. But whether it's going to trigger a longer-lasting immune response is not yet clear. And also these additives are only licensed in some countries or in some parts of the world, so in Europe rather than America or whatever. but it seems like in order to create an immune response that lasts longer, then you want to create a bigger immune response when you have the vaccine, which unfortunately could make you a little bit sicker when you take the vaccine, but it's, you know, in the long run, it may be worthwhile.
Yeah, it seems like a bit of a difficult balancing act going on
there.
Yeah,
that's right.
It's also interesting because, I mean, I guess with the flu, how necessary is it for it to be super long lasting? Because isn't the nature of the flu that it's different every year? So wouldn't it be kind of unnecessary to have a long lasting one that might only be relevant to a particular strain?
Yes, that's very true. So it may not be super necessary for the flu. Although even if, you know, if the flu vaccine isn't effective over an entire season, you could be vaccinated, you know, in the early autumn, and then by the time it gets around to late winter, early spring, you're just not immune anymore, and you could catch it then. So lengthening the immune response may be important. And also you think, well, maybe obviously the whole world is trying to work out vaccines for COVID. Maybe this is an important thing they need to consider, to get a COVID vaccine that lasts longer than, you know, a few weeks or months or years even.
All right, then. So then to move on to our second topic, we've got something here about citation hacking in scientific papers. Now, what is citation hacking? You're going to have to tell us.
Okay, so just like the rest of the world, scientists like to rank themselves. They say, you know, I'm the best because of something, okay? And citations are something that are used to rank the quality of a scientist or a researcher or the impact that they have. And there's various indexes that different websites use to rank people. One is called a H index, which basically takes a look at how often a particular researcher is cited. So in other words, how often his papers or his or her papers are mentioned in other people's work. Yeah. So so if a certain scientist is cited, you know, 20 times in a year, then that may not be so great. But if they're cited a few thousand times in a year, then they've got a much higher index and they are supposedly more impactful in their work.
Right. So is it the case that scientists are kind of sneaking their citations into other people's work somehow?
Right. So if you can get a bit of an advantage, you know, there's a big temptation, or maybe if I can get a few extra citations, then that's what they try and do. And this has been termed citation hacking. In other words, sort of to artificially boost your own citation numbers. There was a recent study, an analysis of about 20,000 authors and their citation patterns, and they found in this group of 20,000, they found 80 scientists whose citations indicate chronic, repeated manipulation of reference lists. And they say about 16% of the authors may have engaged in some degree of reference list manipulation. And so, what does that actually mean? Well, there's various ways that scientists can do this. So they may have, you know, they may be working in a certain area, and a colleague at another university, which they're particularly friendly with, is also working in a similar area, and they say, okay, well, you cite my papers, I'll cite your papers, and we'll boost each other in that way. And that's sort of an artificial way to boost your own citations. Another way, and this is something that I've encountered quite a few times, is when scientists submit their papers to a journal, the journal then takes those articles and distributes them amongst several peer reviewers. So people who are experts in the field, who take a look at the work, make sure it's accurate or it's quality work, and then say, okay, well, yeah, this paper is good enough for publication or not. And very often, in fact, most of the time, the reviewer will come back and say, okay, well, this is good, but you need to change this little bit and add this section and you forgot to do this, that, or the other. So they come back with some things that need to be changed. And very often in that list of changes, they may insert to say, okay, well, you need to cite this paper, and this paper. Wow. And they put in their own papers.
Oh.
Yeah. And this happens a lot. It's happened a lot to me, and I know this is sort of very, very common in science. And And then so that's effectively citation hacking, because when the author gets the paper back, speaking from experience here, you know, you want to do everything they say to make sure your paper gets published. And if it means adding a few references, well, you know, it's no skin off my nose. I'll just stick them in, and then so the author has boosted his or her citation numbers. And so, yeah, so that's another common way of doing it.
And so, I mean, why is this a concern for the integrity of the scientific community, I guess?
Well, I think it's clear scientists want the whole process of doing science, reporting science, making sure that work is done, you know, as rigorously as possible. And they want that whole process to be open and transparent. And if you have, you know, let's say you are looking into a particular field of science, and there's four or five scientists that you're looking at all doing this and working in this field, but one has, you know, 10 times the number of citations as the other, you think, okay, well, this person, this scientist, you know, maybe she's much, much better than this other guy, and so I'm just going to trust her and read her work. And so it biases the consumption of science, I think. It biases how people take those papers and rank them in terms of importance. So I'm going to rely much more on, say, a paper that, or an author that is cited 10 times more than another author. There's a strong feeling, I think, generally, that work should be cited based on its merits and not just on the fact that, and there shouldn't be sort of sneaky ways of getting papers into citation lists, because it clouds the transparency of science. You are adding motivations that really shouldn't be there. If you understand what I mean.
Yeah, absolutely. I feel like this has been quite eye-opening. It's something I did not know went on in the scientific community.
Oh, we're all backstabbing and
yeah. Well, sorry.
Go on. You were gonna.
Well, I was just gonna say, in the interest of time, maybe we should move on to our last topic there.
Absolutely.
Like, so this one was about the explosion, which obviously happened recently in Beirut, which was absolutely devastating. I'm sure people have seen the video, but it killed at least 220 people, injuring more than 5,000 and left an estimated 300,000 people homeless. So what is it that caused that explosion?
Well, it was caused by fertilizer. So it was caused by a chemical called ammonium nitrate, which is widely used to help, you know, grow your crops and grow your food. And as when it's usually made, it's usually very stable. It's made in small little beads that resemble, you know, cooking salt. It's cheap, and it's not usually a problem. The only problem is when it gets stored for long periods, it tends to absorb water. And when it absorbs moisture from the air, it starts to make the little beads, sort of salt crystals, stick together. Just like if you have, you know, your table salt, you know, if you add a bit of moisture, it makes it all clump together. Mm. And when you get these sort of big clumps, sort of rock-sized clumps of this stuff, it starts to become more explosive. And when it's exposed, it's not like if you drop it, it'll go off. But if you're exposed to intense heat from a fire, then that can trigger an explosion when it's in these big clumps. And it looks like this is what happened. So they had 2,750 tons of ammonium nitrate, which is a crazy amount. And it was stored in a warehouse and for a long period. And then there was a fire and it went off. The most incredible thing one of the more incredible things I've seen is that this isn't the biggest ever ammonium nitrate explosion. In 1947 was a bad year, because in the same year, there were two explosions, one in France and one in the US. The French one had 3,000 tons of ammonium nitrate, and the US one just had a tiny little bit less. Both were massive, but they killed fewer people, I think, because they were away from big urban centers. This was much more devastating because of where it was. And the difficulty was compounded in Lebanon because we're in the middle of a COVID crisis. So hospitals were already under strain. There's already political instability in the Lebanon, which means that essential services weren't maybe up to scratch. And so this was a compounded disaster. A lot of work needs to go into trying to rebuild and help Lebanon recover.
Yeah, and perhaps in the use of ammonium nitrate, we need to be thinking about how we're storing it and also possibly where we're storing it.
No, absolutely. And if stored properly, this isn't a problem. This isn't TNT, for instance. This is not something that that is unstable, even if you drop it or something like that. This is a much this is an incredibly useful chemical. This helps to feed the world. This chemical, but if it's improperly stored, then this can happen, and it has a few times. It's emerging that it was a bureaucratic sort of lapse that meant that this was just left to sort of sit there until something happened, and inevitably the something that happened was this.
Mind blowing. That was Dear Science, thanks to MOTAT, Auckland's Museum of Transport and Technology.